This is Eberhard Riedel, My African Journey, Emotional Trauma and the Transcendent Function, In Search of Symbol, Representations of the Collective Unconscious. This was March 9th, 2012. There were numerous images in the DVD of this lecture.
Bunny, thank you very much for the introduction, and to the Jung Society Program Committee, thank you for making this evening possible. And it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you. My wife, Beth, was planning to introduce me tonight. However, she was called away by a family issues at the East Coast. And she asked me that I read what she wrote. That feels a little bit, well, self-indulgent, but I would like to bring her into the room, so let me read a few paragraphs from her introduction. In fact, Beth and I started working on this Africa project together in 2004 in South Africa and Namibia. And since then, it has grown quite a bit, as you heard. Beth writes, Eberhard's passion for this work comes not only from the love of photography and his awareness that the creative process is a major force for healing from emotional trauma, but also from his early history growing up in Germany during World War II. His experiences of what the chaos and destruction of war can do to a young child, how a sense of self and identity can be damaged by an atmosphere of threat and violence fuel his passion. In his work, Eberhard seeks to make the medium of photography available to people young and old living in the aftermath of war-related trauma. The photographic work is coupled with his attunement to the awareness that in order to heal, traumatized people need not just to have their physical needs met, but they need psychotherapeutic support as well. What ties Eberhard's work together, the photography and the psychological attunement, is that in a very real sense, he is bearing witness to the struggle of all those he encounters. The images you will see and the stories you will hear tonight and tomorrow in the workshop speak to the importance of the kind of work he has been doing and his courage in pursuing his passion. Thank you, Beth. So, tonight, I would like us to create space for reflection on how we might better contribute to the healing of the collective in our own individual ways. At all times, we stand with one leg in the personal and the other in cultural collective realm, and social and societal healing requires that we keep in purview both realms. I suggest we focus on such interfaces, like the interface between the personal and the communal realms. Doing so typically invokes uncomfortable feelings, frictions between us and them, the in-group and the out-group, and discordances. But let's catch those. Let's catch those uncomfortable moments. They can tell us something. The stories tonight come from interviews with over 1,000 individuals from field work in three areas. The first one, northern Uganda and southern South Sudan. This is an area where people are suffering from the consequences of more than 20 years of war and violence inflicted by the Lord's Resistance Army rebels, LRA rebels. Secondly, the cross-border areas between Kenya, Uganda, and South Sudan. This is an area where people are haunted by ongoing tribal conflicts. And finally, the third area, Eastern Congo, where what I call a perverse war and violence are still raging in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide from 1994. Preparing for this presentation, I reread Jung's account in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections of his Africa trip to Kenya and Uganda in 1925-26. What Jung thought would be a scientific exploration of primitive men, his words, became an intensely personal, his words, journey. Jung writes, "I enjoyed the divine peace of a still primeval country. Thousands of miles lay between me and Europe, mother of all demons," end of quote. This was after World War I, but before the ascent of Hitler and Stalin, their death camps and gulags, and in 1939, the start of World War II. I was born right then, in 1939, and after 9/11/2001, I was reminded once again of my childhood experiences of terror and bombed-out cities. Had nothing changed? At home and abroad, the virus of racism, fundamentalism, and tribalism, and the terror and violence that this virus spawns are still tearing apart the human fabric. I felt the urge to move beyond the confines of my psychoanalytic consulting room. So in 2004, I started field work in Africa as a photographer and psychologist. I went to listen and to learn at the grassroots level, face to face with Africa. Now, 7 years into the work, after field work in 2001 in Eastern Congo in the spring, and in Uganda, South Sudan, and Kenya in the fall, some concrete plans are beginning to be realized. Faculty at Makerere University in Kampala, Uganda, enthusiastically took up my suggestion of creating a regional East African psychotrauma center that is interdisciplinary, involving psychology, fine and performing arts, and film. It will train professionals from and serve communities in Uganda, South Sudan, Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, and Eastern Congo. The second project, in collaboration with the Great Lakes Foundation for Peace and Justice in Bukavu, Congo, involves developing a network of emergency health and mental health centers in Eastern Congo, especially in the rural areas. Making long-term commitment and building local infrastructure are essential, and I would like to invite you to join and support these efforts. I view psychology as a tool for solving problems. A few months ago, in South Sudan, a man said to me, "The guns are quiet. Now the war is taking place in my mind." The man is suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Yet in many parts of South Sudan and Eastern Congo, a perverse hot war is ongoing, and violence rages both internally and externally. And I say perverse because most victims are women and children. The This photograph shows survivors of a massacre at Makobolo, Congo, in which more than 600 people were murdered in 2 days, and this is just one of many such massacres. These topics make me and may make you feel uncomfortable. Many individuals I encounter are survivors of torture and violence, violated in their basic human rights, robbed of their voices, raped physically and or emotionally, their humanity discarded, the worst of trauma. What I'm doing in Africa is less than a drop in the bucket. This is why I too need community, and I really, really appreciate your presence here tonight and your support. And this is why the people I introduce you to need you. They need you to see them. This is essential for their healing. Besides the millions who lose their lives through war, another consequence of war is that links get broken. Indigenous people like the Batua Pygmy are expelled from their traditional lands. People flee their villages and end up in the slums of big towns. Hundreds of thousands end up in refugee camps and internally displaced people's camps, as they're called, and on and on. When links get broken, when the connectivity with self and others is lost, the result is loss of soul. I've come to realize that tending the emotional wounds of survivors of war, violence, marginalization is essential for creating conditions for societal healing and lasting peace. So the conflict analysis in the different areas that I showed you, the three areas that we will be talking about tonight, involves distinct, complex, tribal, ideological, political, economic components. Any serious peace-building effort must include tending to the emotional injuries of survivors. And unfortunately, in this respect, the Western humanitarian aid industry is failing miserably. The challenges of field work in these difficult environments is holding the tension between exigencies of action and psychological reflection. What are the psychological issues we are addressing? What is psychological trauma? Take this bottle, throw it on the floor, what will happen? It will shatter into many pieces. The harder the blow, the more and smaller the pieces. It's hard to put the pieces back together. By analogy, emotional blows shatter the human mind. The human mind dissociates. Links get broken. So psychologically speaking, emotional trauma is a state of dissociation or fragmentation of the mind. For example, we may need a little less light, but it's okay. For example, this... this woman's mind has been shattered by unbelievable trauma. Grace told me, I was 9 years old when I was abducted in 1994. Lord's Resistance Army rebels held her in captivity and forced her in being a child soldier in northern Uganda. Southern Sudan and Eastern Congo for 15 years before she was able to escape in June 2009. I met her 1 year later. Such trauma and dissociation also occur in the collective, in the culture of a people. And I know this from my native Germany. The Nazi years were like a wall of concrete that cut off people from the rest of their history, good and bad. A shattered bottle cannot hold water. A dissociated mind cannot think. The symptoms are many. Often people suffering from emotional trauma are anxious, experience the most horrendous nightmares, are prone to engage in violent and brutal behaviors, develop psychosomatic illness, engage in addictive behaviors, for example, alcoholism, drug abuse, sexual obsessions, have difficulties relating even to their families and friends, are vulnerable to predator people and propaganda, and trauma gets transmitted to the next generation. How to break the endless cycle of war and violence, that is the question. This requires a capacity to think about what has happened. But the traumatized mind is overwhelmed by powerful affect, is shell-shocked, and is stuck in an emotional prison. Shell-shocked was a term coined after World War I, what we now call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The challenges are to empower and provide psychosocial support to large numbers of individuals and whole communities suffering the traumatic consequences of war, violence, and discrimination. An example are the children. Here are two of my photographs made near Uganda's border to Kenya. And here are two images made by workshop participants near Uganda's border to Congo. There are among well over 500 participants in my psychotherapeutic workshops for youth. I need to go back. For youth and for adults. Everywhere the same story. Here a child in eastern Congo, stitched on her dress, christened for beauty, but imprinted on her psyche is terror. Locked out, she has no access to education. Yet we know that peace starts at the local level with education. These children are waiting. Their community suffered unbelievable trauma. My work in Africa, face-to-face with Africa, has convinced me that without attention to these emotional wounds and injuries of these survivors, humanitarian assistance does not provide sufficient context for reconciliation and lasting peace. This view is neither shared nor practiced by 99% of the humanitarian aid industries in areas I visited. Most of their work is short-term and creates unhealthy dependencies and false hope rather than healing and empowerment. This political question needs addressing, otherwise we donors remain part of the problem. Martin Luther King Jr. observed, "We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny." Concerning psychological trauma, a key observation is that the traumatized psyche is unable to reflect or imagine and thus experience itself isolated from the rest of humanity. This loss of inner and outer connectedness underlies the symptoms of PTSD, And that is what we want to pay attention to. Thus, step one in tending the wounds of psychological trauma is reawakening curiosity in culturally sensitive ways. And yes, reawakening curiosity, not hope. Hope lies and people end up re-traumatized. Curiosity invites action. It does not take me much to model curiosity. Often it's just showing up, starting a conversation, and listening. Someone in South Sudan said to me, "Oh, a white man is traveling here, so something must be different." I believe in the wisdom of the people. Healing starts with regaining a sense of self, one's voice being seen. And the arts are a powerful tool in this process. Artistic engagement dares people to start grieving the tremendous losses they have suffered and breaking down the wall of concrete that keeps them shell-shocked and emotionally imprisoned. How might we create reflective space to help such trauma survivors think about what has happened? In 1916, that is in the midst of World War I, Jung posited a psychological process he termed the transcendent function of the psyche. Transcendent because it links different parts of the mind. But what brings the transcendent function into action? Following Jung's general tenet that psyche abhors being stuck, we might answer, the transcendent function is a development forced on the psyche by the pressure of being stuck in one-sidedness. In other words, the transcendent function develops to deal with stuckness. Almost half a century later, the psychologist Bion said, thinking is the development forced on the psyche by the pressure of thoughts. So he suggests that thinking develops in order to cope with thoughts. I believe Jung's and Bion's ideas are related. Let me explain. As a young man, being married to my late wife, I entered a phase when I felt stuck, alternating between either stay married and feel miserable or divorce and, well, feel miserable. Neither path felt right. Remember Dante's image of finding oneself in the dark wood? Wrestling with my dilemma, a dream occurred in which I walked down a glacier, but then could not move on because my rope was stuck in a crevasse. After much effort, it got unstuck, and I felt great relief. I still remember that feeling of relief. Thus, long before I knew about Jung or Bion, I became aware of the transcendent function as a process in my psyche. My encounter with reality generated sense impressions related to my emotional experience, which I could not think about because it was primarily sensory, hence a state of stuckness. Then the disturbing sensory experience transformed into dream thoughts, a symbolic representation, rope stuck in the crevasse, and thus it became accessible to thinking. Now, and this is important, the freedom that comes with, oh, I can think about this, is experienced as joy. It connects with the larger world, call it the cultural, symbolic layer of the psyche. Now I'm no longer alone. That is, the connection with the cultural layer links me to something larger. My distress, or whatever it is, does not need to be healed by a partner. To the contrary, the glacier ice covering the relationship can melt. A normal human relationship in the mundane world has the potential to be reborn. Now, for the trauma survivor, the process of transmuting sensory experiences into dream thoughts is seriously blocked. Psychological trauma undermines thinking, undermines the transcendent function, and then the normal or mundane world remains frozen over, buried under a big Arctic cake of ice, even in the deserts of Africa. You see this in the photographs of genocide survivor. Former child soldier, overwhelmed by the shadow of his past. Yet, underlying the approach to treating trauma by encouraging artistic engagement is the same idea, namely facilitating reconnecting with the larger world, that is, with nourishing aspects of the cultural symbolic layer of the psyche. And I will talk later about how this idea scales to healing psychological trauma in communities and cultures, because artistic activity can create life-enhancing insights and states of liminality also in groups. The point is not whether the model is correct or not. It is myth. Engaging in such myth-building serves developing a sensibility to relational knowing. The real, or the uncanny, hits you as a numinous experience during the process of relating to yourself or to others. What about the inner world of survivors of extreme psychological trauma? I'm thinking here of my experiences in Congo, Uganda, and South Sudan. For example, the female and male survivors of torture and rape, and the children who were kidnapped and induced into brutal warfare as child soldiers or sex slaves, always under the threat of death. Such acts of terror deliberately and intentionally destroy the primary empathic bond and create an abyss between the sufferer and human community. This self-alienation seems to be the intention of that perverse warfare that I described is happening still in Eastern Congo and South Sudan. Such horrors break the protective shield of the psyche. You remember the image of the shattered bottle. As one eyewitness said, "Now the war takes place in my mind." Thus tormented, the survivor is no longer at home in the normal, everyday world, but condemned to live in the trauma world. Because the traumatized psyche is unable to reflect and imagine, the capacity for the formation of dream thoughts representing the trauma experience is lost. Typical PTSD dreams are about the same old reruns of the traumatizing situations. This collapse of the imaginative capacity and loss of temporality, past, present, future, leaves a horrifying void in the psyche. And this void, which is the trauma world that I talked about, may be sensed as a threatening black hole, the dark night of the soul, threatening to devour everything, or its opposite, a dangerous volcano evacuating violent hot discharges, perverse acting out, and terror. There's a close link between image and affect, which I employ to engage people in storytelling to rekindle curiosity. I involve survivors of trauma in image making. First, my photographs, my own photographs, I display on the screen of my digital camera and invite subjects to talk about what they see. And on return visits, I take prints back to them. Second, I teach photography, the basics of photography, to individuals who have suffered trauma and are marginalized, and encourage them to tell their stories through images. Typically, I work with groups of eight, loaning each person a digital point-and-shoot camera. See, I want people both in front and behind the camera. And indigenous people understand the ritual side of that quite well. At the end of the day, I print three or four photographs for each workshop participants right where we work, and all participate in the magic of a color photograph emerging from the little printer. And then together we learn as we read the photographs. Concerning the ritual side of relating, I like to learn as much as possible about indigenous traditional healing methods, folklore, and art. I find it important to start from the people's own narrative. I had an opportunity to witness and record a Nano Igueno ritual reading the intestines of a chicken of the Akoli tribe in northern Uganda. When I introduced myself to the native healer, he exclaimed, "Okay, you are here to learn how the Akoli protect themselves." And it was very interesting. Right then it flashed through my mind, yes, this is how they build resilience. The next day he participated in my Cameras Without Borders healing ritual. You see, all cultures employ such projective instruments. Here's what I do with my with photography in the field. For example, with pictures taken and selected by workshop participants, I ask, what's the story this picture is telling you? Then I ask the next person, same picture, different story. Aha, projection, right? Other question, what did you experience, feel, when you took this picture out in the community, etc., etc.? When I don't have much time with a group, I use the workshop method to obtain diagnostic information. I get more information than in hours of psychiatric interviews, and the narratives it elicits are filled with affect, pain, and tears. With survivors of crime and violence, I invite some group members to reenact what happened to them, and others to photograph what they witness, a form of psychodrama. This has been quite successful with survivors of sexual violence as well as ex-child soldiers. Always I let them come up with the idea how they want to render something bad that happened to me and something good that happened to me. For example, in Congo, it would be physically unsafe to revisit the places where the crimes actually happened. And then play acting serves to express affect in images, and witnesses and holding the printed photographs in one's hands invites processing affect. That is why I call my approach Cameras Without Borders, Photography for Healing and Peace. It makes people curious. The goal is to help people regain their voice, feel seen, and see themselves in new ways. I am somebody. I made this photograph. I can learn new things, etc. That is a starting point. As Winnicott observed, we need transitional space to play, and vice versa, playing restores transitional space. That's an integral part of healing trauma. Even a temporary respite can reduce anxiety in people whose lives have been shattered by insecurity and trauma, and can provide, however brief, a glimpse that besides the trauma world they inhabit, there exists another reality. A survivor of trauma, of sexual violence, in a workshop exclaiming, "The picture in the camera is like a pregnancy," transcends the limitations of a shattered mind, unable to think about unimaginable trauma. Curiously, then imagining what might be gestating in the camera rekindles the struggle of giving birth to her future, transcending the trauma. So in a nutshell, I blend digital technology with old healing methods. My process is iterative. I observe, I do, I see what's happening, the outcome. Back to the beginning, observe, do, see what's happening. This is how my work has developed and changed over time. I pay careful attention to my uncomfortable feelings, the felt sense, something doesn't feel quite right here, what is going on, and also my dreams, especially during field work. There's no formal consulting room in field work. We try to find places where people feel protected, under an old tree, in someone's hut or cabin, like this man's hut in northern Uganda. Can you see this, or do we need to dim the light? I think we may have to dim the light somewhat. Okay, so no formal consulting room, like in this man's hut in northern Uganda. He alone survived, his two children abducted and wife murdered by Lord's Liberation Army rebels. Regardless which monsters emerge or threaten to intimidate us, be it the deafening noises of a tropical thunderstorm in Congo or the huge empty trucks bouncing from pothole to pothole along a dusty road in Uganda, you sit with the people and listen with your inner ear. We have to be able to empathize with the reality of the trauma without emotionally freezing and thus losing our own capacity for imagination and reflection. Sitting with and listening with the inner ear is in the service of creating moments of attunement between you and the person you're sitting with that can be remembered by the trauma survivor and yourself. And such fleeting moments can induce restorative action by the transcendent function, which itself is a fleeting symbolic process. In my work, I employ photographic images as catalysts to restart such processes. You could view them as dyadic transitional objects. They invite the survivor's search for a deep, nonverbal connection with another mind. In less esoteric terms, to create separation from the trauma world, a narrative reconstruction of the traumatic event needs to take place. Curiosity needs to be sparked. After all, the capacity to be curious to be amazed is connected to reflective consciousness. This is how I employ the photographic process as a speculum, Latin for mirror, to look, see, and explore. And at the same time, I model for the survivor to do the same. Here are examples of portraits I made in Uganda and Congo. At first glance, the images are quite beautiful. They are painted in the Romantic tradition. But taking a second look, we feel something is not quite right. In Wounded Mother, former child soldier, we sense mother's gaze is disconnected from the baby on her lap, no link to baby or observer. In Women at Window, we feel resignation and sadness. The approaching man disturbs me. And in Remembering Congo 2011, we notice the woman's pained body posture and anxious hands. We feel uncomfortable, feel an urge to move on to the next photograph, but it is important that we pay attention to our uncomfortable feelings. These are examples of the real. We sense it, feel it. The real communicates as shock to the imagination, thus transcending limitations of the mind. So artistically speaking, there's a discordance between romantic form or structure and painful content. Psychologically speaking, paying attention to our uncomfortable feelings, grieving the terrible losses and trauma, thinking about what has happened to us, connect us with creative layers of the psyche where healing and renewal originate. If paid attention to, the uncomfortable tension can become psychoactive. It can serve as midwife in a relational process of healing. Call it, as Jung did, the transcendent function at work, which makes visible what cannot be perceived, or like Bion, sense impressions that force thinking to develop. Affect always is a visceral experience. I don't want to leave you with the impression that all trauma wounds can be healed or transcended. Ever since the Rwandan genocide, the people of Eastern Congo have suffered the brunt of a perverse war against humanity. This young woman, Salama, was brutally attacked and violated by several soldiers on three separate occasions, resulting in two pregnancies. She still suffers from painful internal injuries, and in her village, she and her children of violence, as they're called, are shunned and marginalized. Or here, Tabu, she and her husband worked their field when Hutu militia criminals attacked, tied her husband to a tree, whereupon three soldiers sexually brutalized her. 2 weeks later, Hutu militia criminals came to her home. She was in bed, unable to move because of her earlier injuries, and now five soldier criminals sexually attacked her and stole, she says, all things from the house. She told me, quote, "My heart is full of shame." Tabu was one of 16 seriously injured women for whom I was able to arrange admission to Pansy Gynecological Hospital in Bukavu, the only hospital in South Kivu province with gynecologists on staff. The abuses go on and are of epidemic proportions. D Daily, in the rural parts of eastern Congo, militia gangs abduct children and sexually victimize women and men, whether they are young or old, pregnant or disabled. There is no medical treatment for the tens of thousands of injured girls and women, many of whom have died. This is a humanitarian and women's rights issue. If the victims were men, soldiers, male soldiers, they would be taken care of in field hospitals. But what about these women? And I kindly ask you for pledges and donations to help more women receive medical treatment. I will return to Eastern Congo in mid-May for another 2 to 3 months and personally oversee that all funds are used as designated. Even small donations can make a big difference in the lives of these communities. Human rights work and Jungian depth psychological work are a natural fit. Jung is the father of culturally sensitive psychology, in spite of the many blind spots he has in that department. And in his model of the psyche, by a stroke of genius, Jung complemented the conscious versus unconscious dimension with the personal versus collective dimension of the psyche. And he placed its cultural aspects into the quadrant of collective consciousness. Collective trauma cuts off a people from their culture, which then ceases to be available as a vessel for communitas, for community. Not addressing wounds of collective trauma and the related issues of intergenerational transmission of trauma has serious consequences. What might the future hold for this child? The photograph was made in one of the IDP camps in northern Uganda. IDP stands for internally displaced people. When you see images like this, please pay close attention to what you feel, what you sense. Often when we watch such images, there's a pull to dissociate, get sleepy. I heard somebody yawn. Being confronted with massive trauma on a large scale, I quickly learned that I needed to work holistically, which means working with survivors and also their families, communities, and the social and political structure. Why? Because the human fabric is broken. The pieces don't work together anymore. Fragmentation and dissociation rule, which are the typical symptoms of the wound of trauma at the collective level. Here are some observations from the Congo indicative of this wound. Most women I met who survived horrific sexual violence were then abandoned by their husbands and families. Now they find themselves alone, raising children, theirs and many orphans. Why? Most of the former child soldiers with whom I worked were abducted as children and then spent their school years in the bush. Now the ones who survived, and in many areas this is 20 or less than 20%, struggle not only with their physical and emotional wounds, but also with reintegration into a society that shuns and rejects them. Why? Several insightful trauma survivors, men and women, whom I met, stated that personal and societal healing could only happen after the militia criminals are removed from the bush. Why is that not happening? Collective issues in the tribal areas I will address later. Being confronted with such massive collective trauma, I asked myself how the treatment approaches developed in and for the psychotherapeutic consulting room might scale, might expand to large numbers of people, whole communities, and the culture at large. How might one help renormalize the emotional outlook of groups of people being stuck in their respective trauma worlds? How might I receive entry into communities emotionally devastated by massive, deliberately inflicted violence? How might I respond to their feelings of terror and depersonalization, depression and shame, or worse, indifference, even to survival? We will witness this tomorrow in the film, The Day God Walked Away. How might I feel sitting with groups of perpetrators who evacuate trauma or anxiety by violent and perversive acting out, such as destructive sexual violence or senseless acts of revenge? How might I feel sitting with officials who looked the other way when these crimes were committed? I did not come to Africa with a plan, and these questions slowly evolved, learning from each other at the grassroots level. I'm grateful not only to the many villagers I had the fortune of meeting, but also the local professionals and volunteers for their assistance, without which this work could not be done. This is Rod Chiba, a young lawyer in Eastern Congo. Beatrice, a social assistant, also in Congo, here writing her case notes. Or David Oaken, a social worker from Gulu in northern Uganda, in contacts to South Sudan. As I reflect on where my field work is taking me, I see that it is areas of cultural interfaces and intangible conflicts, intangible because of a tangle of multiple cultural interfaces. Here I am meeting with elders of the Turkana tribe in northwestern Kenya. Tending issues across interfaces opens up possibilities to effect change in communities, and here's why. Cultural interfaces are in between places, for example, literally in between the past and an uncertain future, or figuratively in flux situations when things normally taken for granted change or shift in our perception, like central values, axioms for the culture. In states of great intensity or urgency, called liminal stages, from Latin limen, threshold, by Victor Turner, such situations create thresholds of unpredictability and possibility, i.e. potential for change, either positive or negative. In Jungian language, these are moments of numinosity, from Latin numen, the power or not of a deity. And these numinosity states are characterized by the presence of large affective energies, again, positive or negative. Furthermore, remember that what Jung said about dreaming in a letter to Kirsch, and I'm reading, "With regard to your patient, it is quite correct that her dreams are occasioned by you. The patient's mind is waiting for the seed. That's the meaning of the transference. Always the more conscious one fecundates the more unconscious person." I guess we're losing the sound. Hello?
your mic off.
What's going on?
Congratulations.
Okay. Whatever. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
What about now?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So he said, always the more conscious one, fecundates the more unconscious person. In the deepest sense, we all dream out of what lies between us and the other. You see why I believe in the relational aspect of peace work. Being with people and listening with an inner ear may constitute the interpersonal process dimension of the transcendent function and thus create potential for genuine change. And by that I mean change that is not imposed but homegrown. As with individual trauma survivors, now with communities, you model behaviors that expand their capacity to be present and listen inwardly to what truly matters to them. Can you still hear me? Okay. In long meetings with people in rural areas and tribal areas, I've come to appreciate their thoughtful demeanor, remarkable relational skills, and courage to address their fears. Like here with the elders of the Turkana tribe in Kenya, one person speaking to me, or here survivors of sexual violence in Eastern Congo. Through my work in Africa, I've learned to distinguish between three groups of people. First, the people who are more or less securely held by their tribal structure and values. Second, the educated and pretty much westernized Africans who successfully transitioned to a new system of societal values. And third, the very large number of in-between people uprooted by war and violence who are anchored neither in tradition nor modernity. And it's this latter group which not only carries heavy burden of memories of past injustice, but also they are the most vulnerable to being seduced into becoming aggressors. That was another Eastern Congo survivor of sexual violence in one of my workshops. Photographs can be visceral emotional experiences that convey a story and shock the imagination. Rebuilding civil society in the desolate areas of northern Uganda and South Sudan, haunted by decades of war, is about the renewal of the human spirit. As I was documenting destruction in the Amuru IDP, internally displaced people's camp, and trading center in northern Uganda, I'm losing the microphone. Well, talking first about this, then this, second, and third this. Sorry. The man on the right walked up to me and wanted to participate. The young man in the back doorway had observed me the previous day and begged for a chance to work with me. The third man's refuge is psychosis. Who knows what happened to him? What happened to his psyche during more than 20 years of wars and atrocities committed by North Resistance Army rebels. Being stuck in these internally displaced people's camps without land for gardening is a sentence to hunger in regions where subsistence farming is the rule. This 83-year-old woman, Selina, also in the Amuro camp, goes for days without food. She told me her greatest pain is not being able to help feed her children and grandchildren. She maintains her dignity by making brooms, which she sells for about 12 cents apiece, 8 of them on a good day. This is another context in which I'm seeking donations for building up the Makerere University Institute so that local people can be trained who will work in the rural areas. And I have already field faculty and candidates who know these areas and seek training, but no means to support them. You see, during the decades of acute crisis and warfare in northern Uganda from about 1986 to 2006, international organizations and NGOs provided food aid and other humanitarian assistance. All of this is gone now. LRA rebels under Joseph Kony militarily dominated the whole northern part of Uganda and southern Sudan as far north as Yuba. The LRA were and are supported by the Khartoum government of North Sudan and are still active in Western South Sudan, Darfur, Central African Republic, and Northeastern Congo. And people are still stuck in these IDP camps all over northern Uganda with no place to go, either physically or mentally. Truly, trauma is a wall of concrete that cuts people off from their lives, history, and culture. Many are sick with HIV/AIDS or other diseases. Many cannot afford to send their children to school, like this woman who cares for 18 children, 15 orphans from family members who lost their lives in the war, and 3 of her own. When I listen to people's dreams, they're full of horror, images of disease and suffocation. Their sense of self is flattened. This is the environment these children inhabit and through which psychological trauma is transmitted to them. Yes, these are typical aftermath stories, mostly shrugged off by local politicians and world opinion. Yet worrisome, as they breed the seeds for the next cycle of violence. People attack the targets of their negative projections. But there are healthier people in the camps who show amazing resilience. They may start an outdoor beauty salon or find little plots for gardening, like this woman grinding sorghum. Unfortunately, she also is suffering from AIDS transmitted through sexual assault. In taking photographs, I respond to shock, my uncomfortable feelings, the felt sense something is not what it seems. It's everywhere. Here is women in front of gate processing sorghum. Why the strong high fence? Or observe the pastoral African landscape. Why is the cattle grail right in the center of the village? The photographs were made 2 years ago in 2010 in Karamoja, the tribal lands of northeastern Uganda, bordering Kenya and South Sudan. At the time of Jung's visit, these were closed territories because the tribes resisted colonization. Here, different kinds of conflicts occur in which hundreds of people get killed and people live in fear, like these women of the Ik tribe. The tribes conduct raids and cattle rustling with an eye for an eye sense of justice, a deterioration of respect for human life after decades of war and the influx of firearms, years of serious drought and famine, and mismanaged humanitarian aid. I worked with a group of women of the Pokot tribe in southeastern Uganda. 70% of them were widows. I found similar rates of widows in other communities I visited in the interborder areas of Uganda, Kenya, and South Sudan. This Pokot woman had lost her husband just the previous week, and she asked, "How do we change the minds of our men such that they refrain from cattle raids?" I take her question quite seriously. It is an archetypal question. Did not Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright, have a character ask the same question after World War I? Then, near Owa, in the Kenyan Rift Valley, I met these Pokot men. Defeated and dejected, they had just survived a raid by the Turkana tribe to the north with nothing but their naked lives. This is the water hole they and another 150 people depend on for drinking water. A disaster in the making. I decided to find out for myself and to meet some Turkana people. The Turkana are a nomadic tribe concentrated in northwest Kenya. All these tribes are beautiful people. Here are people of the Jia tribe. The women harvesting, and the men making granaries. The Jia are a sub-tribe of the Karamojong. They are now agro-pastoralists. For years, the Ugandan army engaged in a brutal disarmament campaign against them that left 1,000 dead, villages burned, and animal herds severely decimated. So first it was the British, now the Ugandan army, subjugating these people. A tragical cultural interface. A young Jia, the son of a chief who was killed, said, "Without animals, we have no culture. The Turkana still have what we lost." Where once he grazed his clan's animals, now Turkana graze theirs. So the Turkana herds have gotten smaller too, signaling threats to nomadic life in general. At this point in time, the Jia see in the Turkana of Kenya hope for renewal of their pastoralist lifestyle, yet another cultural interface. Some promising collaborations with local peacemakers are slowly emerging, as well as ideas about addressing psychological and cultural traumata in the interborder tribal areas, Uganda, Kenya, South Sudan. For example, during the next return visit, Cameras Without Borders plans to bring together in photography camps youth from different neighboring tribes to foster mutual understanding. The tribal elders loved that idea, and these are photos from last year's workshop with people of the Ik tribe. Oops, I guess I'm behind, sorry. From last year's workshop with people of the Ik tribe. Let me conclude. Why do I do this work, working for social healing and peace? Waking up one morning towards the end of my field work in Congo last year, the answer came in the words, knowing things entails certain responsibilities. Knowing things entails certain responsibilities. My process is simple, learning from fieldwork experiences in an iterative fashion. Artistic engagement dares people to begin grieving the tremendous losses they have suffered and breaking down the barriers that keeps them shell-shocked and emotionally imprisoned. This idea expands to healing or transcending psychological trauma in communities and the culture, because artistic activity creates, as I said earlier, life-enhancing experiences and states of liminality also in groups. When people reconnect with something larger, that is their cultural values, I often hear them say, "I cannot give up. This struggle is about something bigger than me." My idea of empowerment is to help people to help themselves and then others. We'll have much more to say about this topic tomorrow. However, I describe difficult situations requiring urgent action, especially in eastern Congo and South Sudan. And sometimes outside intervention is necessary. Oops, I guess I'm behind now. This is another of the workshop pictures. It does rain in Africa. Sometimes outside intervention is necessary. Many Congolese women and men, feeling disempowered and abandoned by their government, saw my visit as a sign for hope and asked me to appeal on their behalf to the international community for help in removing foreign militia criminals from their land. Several women said, for example, that they would rather die than return to the field, die from hunger, than return to the fields where they were attacked, where they suffered sexual attacks by militias. Such acts of destructive violence continue on a daily basis. So tonight, I appeal to you to advocate for and support the people of Eastern Congo. If you have messages, I shall gladly deliver them. Please also consider donating money and or purchase any of these photographs. All income goes 100% to survivors to receive emergency medical care. Rebuilding civil society requires long-term commitment and building local infrastructure. Yet, our humanitarian industries, though effective in short-term crisis intervention, tend to undercut local communities and governments in developing their human and economic resources. All too often, I've seen them piggyback old colonialist attitudes rather than building relationships and empowering communities. And I'd be happy to talk about this and give more details tomorrow. And this is really a political as well as a humanitarian question. So I have initiated, as I mentioned at the beginning, and I'm working on two regional pilot projects with faculty at Makerere University to establish a regional East African psychotrauma center to train professionals and serve communities in the conflict areas we talked about tonight. And second, with professional staff of the Great Lakes Foundation for Peace and Justice in Bukavu, Congo, to develop a network of emergency health and mental health centers in the rural areas. I'm seeking donations for another $10,000 of in seed money to get these projects to a stage where they become viable. All donations are tax deductible when you send them through Blue Earth Alliance, which acts as fiscal agent for Cameras Without Borders. And I put pledge sheets on various tables, so please pick up pledge forms, return them to me, or mail them to Blue Earth. Finally, peace starts locally with education. Yet, in the three regions I talked about, thousands and thousands of children have no access to school and health care, which increases their vulnerability to intergenerational transmission to trauma. I have no idea how to address that issue. Somehow I sense that we need a systems approach to dealing with psychological trauma in these areas, aspects of which I have talked about tonight. The psychosocial and economic costs of not doing so are enormous. I thank you, and I'm looking forward to our conversation tonight and tomorrow.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.